gospel and all this, and does this mean that the promises were made void? Something? What? How does this all fit together? Paul's been explaining here all through this that the plan was not just the Jews. All along it was not just the Jews. And this mystery that is being revealed is that the Gentiles are part of this plan all along. And we see this, you know, from the beginning parts of this letter, where he said to the Jew first and also the Greek, that the Gentiles were under condemnation, and also the Jews were under condemnation, all needed the gospel. So this theme continues on and on through here. This is the main, it's a main theme of Romans. You look at the plain fact that very few in Israel had been true to God all the way down through. There was always just a remnant, just a few that were really true. We can see a lot of examples of what Paul talks about, how the people of Israel would reject God, they'd go astray, he'd bring some back. And this thing happened over and over down through their history. And finally, the message goes out to the Gentiles. Even when Jesus came, he had his direct mission to the Jews. When he went out, or when he sent the 12 out, in Matthew 10, 5, and 6, he instructed them to not go in the way of the Gentiles, and do not enter any city of the Samaritans, but rather go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That was the first thing. First to the Jews. Give them the first chance. And then in Matthew 15, where he was talking to the Syrophoenician woman, where she came and begged him to heal her daughter. And he didn't even answer her. And his disciples said, she just keeps yelling at us. Can we get rid of her? And then she came and begged him directly to heal her daughter. And he said to her, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she continued to beg. And he said, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. This seems kind of cold-hearted. But as she continued to ask, he did say, woman, your faith is great, and healed her daughter for her. In John 4, when he's talking to the woman at the well, he seems to open up or hint at things a little more, because he told her, you worship what you do not know, we worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people, the Father seeks to be his worshipers. He didn't say, oh, just among the Jews. Such people, the hour's coming when those who worship in spirit and truth will be his people. So this seems to be hinting there that this message is going to go out farther. A little bit more of this. On the day of Pentecost, it was 3,000 Jews who heard this, or 3,000 Jews who received the message on that day. So again, I mean, they were the ones in the temple. So they were the first ones to receive it. But as the church grew and opposition grew and the persecution began and they spread out, they went everywhere and started taking the gospel out. And we know how with Cornelius, the door was open to the Gentiles. And there was it was a rocky road there for a while as they decided, are the Gentiles really supposed to be included in this? But the answer was yes. And this is part of this whole mystery that Paul is unraveling here of, yes, they were included in the plan from the very beginning. This was a mystery that had been hidden, but Paul was explaining that. And with the hope, as he said several times, that it would make the Jews jealous. You know, he would magnify his ministry such that he would hope that some of his countrymen would be moved to jealousy. They would want what the Gentiles were receiving. and so become believers themselves. This interplay is underlying this whole section. That screen is not on, if there's something that can be done about that. And I'm not getting a response with the clicker. It worked. Am I missing something? Oops. It worked. Am I out of range up there? I don't know. Charles has a magic touch. I hope. We run into this expression here in 10. Let's go on. Now, maybe I need to walk over here again. I am pushing the right button. Oh, here we go. Maybe. The Jews' practice of religion, Paul begins with, he reiterates his love for his people. That, but they were zealous, but without knowledge. They had a zeal. They wanted to do what was right, but they were not doing the right thing. They weren't listening to God's plan in order to actually do what was right. They had not heeded the gospel. Now, we can look around today at the people around us, and we see a lot of people that have zeal, but they're not doing what the Bible says. Should we take that as a warning to ourselves? We need to watch ourselves and make sure that we are, you know, we don't go off track, because it is so easy to go off track. They had tried to make their own way, but it was based on law-keeping and not on faith. And so they were rejected because of that. Verse 4 talks about, for Christ is the end of the law. Now, exactly what that, which way that should be understood, we're not sure. Law could mean the termination, the end of it. That he completed it. This thing is really not responding well. Radio links. Does having just two bars on the battery make a difference? It is kind of a long range out there. The end of the law could talk about a goal. It could talk about it being the end. That didn't seem to help matters. Oh, there we go. An interesting thing here is that in the Greek, there's not the definite article. It does not say end of the law, it's end of law. So it may be that Paul was not so much talking about the law of Moses as the idea of righteousness being based on law keeping. We're not really clear about that one. So we know that faith is the basis. This is not going well. It keeps flashing the little sign up at the top like it's not got the connection. 3. It's interesting. This is on top of all kinds of computer problems I've had in the last few days. Okay, we'll just see what we can do. Can you just advance it one? Thank you. Verse 5. For Moses writes that the man who practices the righteousness which is based on law shall live by that righteousness. But nobody could. Nobody did successfully keep all of the law. And there's another scripture that says that if you violate it, you know, cursed is the one who does not do everything that's written in the law. Any luck? Oh, good. In verses 6 through 8, we have this statement. But the righteousness based on faith speaks as follows. Do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? The word is near you, in your mouth and in your heart. That is the word of faith which we are preaching. Paul used this thing that was from Deuteronomy 30, 11 through 14. And he did switch a little bit of the terminology there. He used abyss instead of sea. In Deuteronomy, it says, who will go across the sea to bring it back, talking about God's law. But here, David Roper speculated, maybe Paul was using these extremes to refer to the unbelief of the Jews, that they didn't think that Christ had actually come from heaven, so nobody's got to go up to heaven to bring him down. And they didn't believe he was raised from the dead. So he said, no, you don't have to do that. This has already happened. These extremes were part of the Jewish culture, so to speak. They were understood to be the impossible. You can't go up to the extreme. You can't go way across there. But just as was said in Deuteronomy, the word is near you. It's in your heart. That is not an impossible thing. That, in fact, now what? The gospel is not too difficult for us. And the righteousness of God is attainable. In 9 and 10, we have this believe and confess, which is something that's often cited. The verb tense in the Greek is, if you know these things and what they all mean, present, passive, indicative, focusing just on present, really. It's a continuing action. It's a continuing sense that the believing and confessing must be something that we do. It's a way of life. It's the way of the new life that we were raised to when we came up from the waters of baptism. He quotes Isaiah 28:16. Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. Now, that's the New American Standard. That last bit, not be disturbed, there are others that say, will not hurry, or will not rush here and there. All of them seem to have a sense of, will be at peace. That sense of peace and abiding. In 10, 12, and 13, it comes back to this thing about there being no distinctions. This echoes or sounds a lot like what we had in chapter 3, where Paul used a similar phrasing about there being no distinctions. where he says, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all those who believe, for there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. That was about the need for salvation. Here he's talking about the basis of salvation, where he says, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, abounding in riches for all who call on him. For whoever will call on the name of the Lord will be saved. All have to have the same faith. He quotes Joel 2:32 about calling on the name of the Lord. This is one of those passages that has been taken out of context, I guess. So many say, well, all you have to do is call on the name of the Lord and you will be saved. You just pray this prayer. Everybody's heard of the sinner's prayer. In researching this a little bit, I went online and looked up what people had to say about sinner's prayer. And some of them said, well, no, it's not in the Bible, but parts of it are scriptural. You know, bits. But no, they essentially said, we can't point to this as the way a person is supposed to be saved, but we're still telling you that's the way you're supposed to be saved. Didn't make a lot of sense. Paul goes through this logical sequence of, if this is going to happen, this has to happen, and if this is going to happen, this other thing has to happen, but he did it backwards. We'll turn it around here. Somebody has to be sent so that they can preach the gospel, so that others can hear the gospel, so that they can believe the gospel, so that they can call on the Lord. Paul turned it all backwards about, you know, how are they to... I'll mess it up terribly if I do it. But he said, you want to get here? Well, you've got to have this step, but you need this in front of it, and that in front of that, and that in front of that. This process, Jim McGugan wrote, it is Christ through his messengers who is pleading with people to be reconciled. It's not just us. When we go out and talk to people, it's not just us. It is Christ through his messengers who is pleading with people to be reconciled. Isn't that an incredible thought? Doesn't that give dignity? No, more than dignity, awful splendor to commissioned proclamation. In true proclamation, Christ appeals to people to trust him. And we get to be part of that. Sunday evening, Derek was up here and he was talking about the honor it is to proclaim God's word. It is such a privilege and honor for us to be able to do that. But they didn't all believe. And he quotes Isaiah, Lord, who has believed our report? Then, but I say, have they not heard? Yeah, they've heard. Indeed they have. The voice has gone out into all the world. There are this series of excuses that Paul anticipated. Have they not heard? But I say, did Israel not know? First Moses says, I will make you jealous by that which is not a nation. By a nation without understanding will I anger you. God is using the Gentiles to get under their skin, to anger them. Kind of rubbing their noses in it. Look at the blessings that I'm giving these that you're not getting because you're not listening. But Isaiah is very bold and says, I was found by those who did not seek me. I became manifest to those who did not ask for me. But as for Israel, he says, All the day long I have stretched out my hands to a disobedient and obstinate people. This reinforces the statement in 9:30 and 31, which was the thing about what shall we say then? That Gentiles who did not pursue the righteousness attained righteousness, even though the righteousness which is by faith, but Israel pursuing a law of righteousness did not arrive at that law. So we move into chapter 11. Has God rejected his people? Paul points to himself. He was a Jew. He was a Jew's Jew. Tribe of Benjamin. He had been schooled under Gamaliel. He was a Pharisee, certainly zealous. And now he was a Christian. Certainly he could point to himself as an example that God had not rejected the Jews as individuals. As the people, yes. As individuals, no. There were 3,000, roughly 3,000 on the day of Pentecost. And I believe it's Acts 20 or 21 somewhere. It says, and there are many thousands more. But even with all this, it's still just a remnant. By no means is it all the people. It's not all the Jews. It is just a remnant. A little Venn diagram exercise. We have all of mankind represented by the big blue blotch. A subset within that is the Jews. Now today, Jews represent 0.2% of the world population. That's 1 out of every 500 people is Jewish. That's not very many. And it probably wasn't very much different in those days. We have this intersecting circle, which is Christians. And that little slice in between there were the Jewish believers. So this is just a remnant of the Jews, a small portion of the Jews who actually came into the church. Looking at some other remnants down through history, of course, you had the flood with just 8 people saved. Noah, his 3 sons and their wives and his wife. You look at Sodom and Gomorrah. 4 people left. Lot, his wife, and his 2 daughters. And his wife looked back and she was lost. In the day of Elijah, after the episode with the prophets of Baal, who's the nasty queen? Jezebel, yeah. When Jezebel threatened him, saying, you're going to be like them tomorrow, he took off running, and he thought, that's it, I'm alone, I'm the last one. He prayed to God, take it, just take me, it's all over. God said, no, there are 7,000 that I have kept who have not bowed their knee to him. In Matthew 7:13 and 14, enter by the narrow gate. Only a few find it. So never is it everyone. Never is it this big number. It's always just a small slice. You think about remnants, and you can think about those who came back from Babylon, but this doesn't work as well because only about 20,000 were deported. And according to Ezra, 42,360 came back. They had a little time to multiply while they were in Babylon. Here we get into a really touchy passage. This thing about the hardening of the Jews. This is a passage that lots of people have taken and really made some stuff out of. maybe I'm jumping just a little bit ahead here. But he said that some would receive, the ones who would receive by faith and accept that justification is by faith. For the rest, they were hardened. Now, we have a number of things where it talks about God hardening someone's heart, such as Pharaoh. But we don't have any place where it suggested that God just said, okay, you're going to be, you know, you don't have a chance. It was after people had rejected him in some way that they may have been hardened. Although we still had just read recently how God made choices. And who are we to answer back to him to say, oh, you shouldn't have done it that way? He made us. He made everyone. And he could do as he wills. Although it really seems to be his will that we come to him. That offer is made, but there's a very definite way that that is to be done. There's still hope, though. The Jews may have rejected him. They may have been hardened. Most of them rejected the gospel. And now we have this thing. Boy, this is... I say then, they did not stumble so as to fall, did they? May it never be. This is understood to mean they did not stumble or fall in such a way, well, say fall, as to be condemned permanently. They still had an opportunity to come back. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make the Jews jealous. Now, if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure is riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? How great would it be to have the Jewish people believe and come in? The richness that they would bring from their heritage. You know, we're a bunch of nobodies. I mean, those of us who weren't born Jewish, we're sort of nobodies, and we don't have this heritage, but the richness of that heritage coming into the church could really help us understand probably a lot of things that we don't get or don't get easily. So this again is that pattern of the Jews were rejected, they rejected God, he rejected them, and then the Gentiles are brought in to make them jealous, to make them want what they're not getting. When they see the blessings of God going to these other peoples, they say, why aren't we there? We're supposed to get that. In hopes that some would turn back. In 8:16 or 11:16, this is from the Complete Jewish Bible, talking about if the first fruits are holy, this is the way it's rendered there. Now, if the challah offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole loaf. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. This thing was to take a lump of the dough. When you're making a loaf, you'd take a lump of the dough, and this was set aside for the priests, for the Levitical priesthood. And if you look online, you can find some very, very complicated instructions about how that is to be done. They say if the loaf is less than this size, don't bother. If the loaf is something like 1 kilogram or more, then you take this much. And in some cases, it has to be done with a blessing. And sometimes if it wasn't done with a blessing, maybe you did it afterwards. But there's this incredible complexity that they have built around this of just taking this bit, this small portion for the priest. But the point that Paul's driving is if the beginning, if the root is holy, the rest of it is also. Now, what's the meaning that we are to take for the first fruits or the root? Doesn't say exactly, but we could think of John 15 with I am the vine, and you are the branches. That certainly seems to fit. But also Abraham was the first one. The promise was made to him. And as far as the Jews or the nation of Israel is concerned, Abraham was the beginning. And the rest were have a certain favored position because of that. The promises were made to his descendants. Well, physical, yes. Spiritual, yes. It's kind of complicated. We don't have a real clear statement of what exactly this is to mean. He goes on with this thing about the olive tree. And the olive tree was used several times in the Old Testament as a figure for the nation of Israel. So natural branches were broken off. Those who did not believe were broken off so that wild branches could be grafted in. That's us, at least that's me. I wasn't born Jewish. But Paul says, in essence, watch your attitude. Because the first thing that somebody says, oh, well, they were broken off so that I could be put in their place. Not really. In fact, there seems to be a bit of irony where Paul responds, oh, quite right. Or the complete Jewish Bible, I think, expressed it as true, but so what? You know, it's not that God didn't have room and could only take a certain number, so he had to get rid of some so that others would fit in. God could make everybody fit in. But he has the power to graft in those who were not born in or not naturally part of that tree. But then the warning is, it's by faith that you stand. So don't get a fat head. Don't think that, oh, I'm something special. I'm above them. God really expects the same thing from all the branches, that is, faith and obedience. How many times have we been taught this lesson? How many examples do we have? Things like the prodigal son's brother. He was jealous because, you know, he was there, he had the riches all along. But then his brother got this special stuff. The workers in the master's vineyard who complained about their pay because they made an agreement for a certain amount, but then somebody else came in later and the master gave them the same thing and they said, oh, no, that's not fair. But it's not their business what the agreement was with the other. We were told to take the lower seat, not to put ourselves up and say we're something special, to associate with the lowly, do not show partiality. He who would be greatest in the kingdom must be the servant of all. All these warnings about this attitude of I'm something special. Paul went on to say, they can be put back in, you know, if they have, you know, the rejection, the jealousy, acceptance. If they accept God, if they come in faith, they can be grafted back in. God has the power to do it. His offer still stands. He has not reneged on his promise. He has not said, nope, that's it, you're out of here. His offer is still valid. Come in faith. Trust me. Believe in me, not this kind of observational rote thing that you try to make out of the law. Oh, this is this is one of the, oh, back up here. This is one of the most mangled passages. Last time when I did this in the spring, I just skipped it. I didn't even want to touch it. But here, this statement, starting in 25, "For I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and so all Israel will be saved." Premillennialists take that and say, okay, there are a certain number of Gentiles that are going to be saved, and then when that's over, bam, all the Jews are going to believe, and all of Israel is going to be saved. Doesn't fit with the rest of Scripture. We don't find that teaching anywhere else. So they've taken a kind of difficult passage here and based their whole theology on it. What is the mystery? I would not have you ignorant, to be uninformed of this mystery. What mystery is Paul talking about? When he uses the term mystery, it's not so much the way we think of mystery today. This is actually a transliteration of a Greek word that essentially says a truth that is revealed. Would someone read Ephesians 3, 4 through 6? And verse 6 also.
That the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise, Christ, through the gospel.
Here, in this other letter, Paul's essentially saying, in very short form, this is the mystery of Christ. This is the thing that he's been explaining in great detail in Romans. That the Gentiles are fellow heirs, also partakers in this richness of God's grace. That's the mystery. That is what had been hidden for ages. That is what had been revealed to the apostles and the prophets, and they had written of it, but it wasn't well understood. But with the apostles, they were preaching this, that the Gentiles were fellow heirs, could be fellow heirs. This is the mystery that Paul's talking about. This is what he's revealing. It's what he's been explaining all through Romans, that Jews and Gentiles are in the same boat. We all are under condemnation. We all need salvation. We all need God's grace. And here, that is what he's explaining some here also. The hardening has been talked about. The fullness of the Gentiles. Many will take that to mean that there is a certain number, but, well, again, that's not taught anywhere else. We don't have anything else in all of the Bible that says there's going to be a certain number. So we need to look for another explanation or another way of understanding this fullness. Fullness here is the noun. It's a thing that completes, fills up. So Gentiles coming in. It was part of the plan. We are part of the plan. Yes, Robert.
It's the same word that oftentimes we see here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perfect, complete, these things going together, yeah. So the Gentiles are sort of filling up, that's a crude way of putting it, but sort of filling up the church. I mean, they're coming in, bringing all of their heritage and everything with them. I don't know if that's what's intended with the fullness, but it is, this is not such a mysterious thing. Thank you. Did you all hear that? He said that the fullness completes the plan. The first part was the message went to the Jews, and then it was opened up to everybody else, the Gentiles. That's it. That's everybody. That completes the plan of who is to hear and who is to receive this offer of grace. Mm-hmm. If we can move on. The last bit then, they refer to as a doxology. Paul has been explaining some difficult things. He's giving a glimpse into the mind of God. And in explaining this, you know, the more you see of it, the more amazed we become. He just kind of breaks out into this praise. A final comment here. We, as the foolish nation of the Gentiles, really can't appreciate the situation that existed in the first century. We don't really get that conflict and how much the Jews, a change of outlook it took for the Jews to accept this. Most Jews, even today, continue in disobedience to the gospel and are just repulsed at the idea that Gentiles should be on equal footing with them because they have this mindset, this heritage of we are special. And in a way they are. But God has also opened up to the Gentiles or to the Greek also. But just the last note, we all need to guard our hearts. We've been warned, severely warned. Note then the kindness and the severity of God. Kindness provided we continue in his grace, severity if we go off the track. And so next week, we will begin chapter 12, which is the beginning of the practical applications section of Romans. And I kind of breathe a sigh of relief thinking, oh, it gets easier. Every time I think that, it doesn't get easier. But any comments? I don't think we've had a bell yet. We've heard? It has been? Okay. I guess we're done then. Thank you very much.